questions. I think Chris is expected.
Yeah.
Chris McCahill is a new member both of the Transportation Commission and the Transportation Policy and Planning Board. He replaced Ash in that capacity, and he's the Deputy Director of State Smart Transportation Initiative at UW. And he brings a lot of experience and a lot of expertise to the Commission and to the Policy Board. So looking forward to his participation. And just a reminder to everybody, this is just a technical reminder. I watched the last video because I was looking for some stuff. And see what I just did? I looked over at Gary. So you can't hear. When people turn their head away from the mic, you can't hear on the recording. So just a little reminder. There were, I don't know if you noticed this too, Patrick, but there are times when the sound just fades away and you can't hear anything. So, see, I keep turning my head. So, reminder to me and a reminder to everybody. Okay, did everybody have a chance to look at the minutes?
Move approval.
I'll second.
There's a motion and a second. Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, motion carried. And here's Chris McCahill.
Hey.
So we just gave a little introduction for
you.
Yeah. So welcome. Welcome, Chris. Okay.
And on the minutes is or maybe this is there any way to have a link to the actual minutes?
Patrick's going to have to answer that, but there is a link to the actual minutes once they're approved. Is that correct, Patrick? Grant was just asking if there's a way to get a link to the minutes, but they don't get posted in Legistar until after they're approved. That's why he emails them out to people.
Gives you a chance to look at
right. So he emails them out with the email about the meeting, and then so like if you look at the last at the meeting before last, they'll be out there posted in Legistar because they're approved. And after tonight, the minutes from the last time will be out there as well. Okay? Did I explain that right? Okay. Do we have anybody who wants to make public comment on topics that aren't on the agenda tonight? We do have some registrants on. Looks like they're all here to talk about item F1. So if anybody's here to speak about something that's not on the agenda, you're welcome to have 3 minutes. No? Okay. Any disclosures or recusals tonight? No? Okay. Then we'll move to item F1. And before we get into discussing it and into the presentation, so how we would normally handle this is we'll have the presentation, then we'll have the public comments, and then we'll have the discussion. I just want to remind everybody that there are two resolutions that we're dealing with on the 300 on South Broome Street and the 300 block of West Wilson Street. There's the interim recommendation for South Broome and the 300 block of West Wilson, contingent on the successful pilot. We recommended approval of that back on April 24th, went to the Board of Public Works on the 8th of May. They approved it. The Council on June 11th referred it to the Transportation Policy and Planning Board. As noted in the latest version of the resolution on July 1st at the TPPV, Alder Foster moved to accept the report, not adopt the recommendation, recommending the final design and construction for the 300 block of West Wilson not be approved until Wilson Street Corridor Study is completed. And I believe this resolution is scheduled to be considered by the Council on July 16th. What's before us this evening is the companion, what I would call a companion resolution. Different ledge file number. And it's titled Approving Plans and Specs and Schedule of Assessments for West Wilson Street and South Broome Street. Went to the Board of Public Works on May 22nd, and it was referred here to the Transportation Commission. Just a reminder that it's our our purview, our jurisdiction is really to look at the road geometry, the geometric design. That's really what's within the scope of the authority of the Transportation Commission. On June 12th, we referred the item so that we would have the benefit of knowing what happened at the Transportation Policy and Planning Board on July 1st. So it's back here today. So I've done some homework on what could we do with this resolution this evening. I'm just going to throw out some options, and then they'll be out there for everybody to think about and discuss. We'll hear from staff as well, and from anybody else who wishes to. And Mike Revere, the alder for the district, is here as well, and he's welcome to come up to the table and address us as well. So first would be to recommend that the resolution be placed on file without prejudice. Now, what does that mean? It means that it's not permanently dismissed. So it can be, it's basically placed on file, kind of like what the Transportation Policy and Planning Board did. They said place it on file and wait till the full study is completed. So my impression in talking with John Strange is that's what that would accomplish. Second would be to recommend to be placed on file with prejudice, and what that legal term means is that it would be dismissed permanently. So the first one is more flexible than the second. The third, we could refer it out to our next meeting, which would be after the council considers the interim recommendation, so we could find out what happens at the council meeting. We could refer it to a future meeting way down the, a few months down the road, until after the Wilson Street corridor study is completed and approved, which basically is the same thing as the first one. So the first one might be a little bit neater. Or we could recommend approval. Have I missed any options? Missed any options?
No.
Okay. So, background, because this is complicated with what we have coming and going. So, first, I'll turn it over to Gretchen, and we can have a presentation so we know what we're talking about. Then we'll hear from a member of the public. If you wanted to speak, please fill out a registration form and get it over here to Patrick, and then we'll have our discussion. So, Gretchen.
Okay. Thank you. So, Gretchen Aviles, City Traffic Engineering, and I will do a quick summary of the recommendations and an update on the design. Anne already took care of the background for these two resolutions, so I just skipped those two slides. We did a trial at West Wilson Street and Broome. We reduced the lanes northbound on Broome to one lane and eastbound on Wilson to one lane. We saw that there were some queuing issues. We did changes to the timing, and these are some pictures before we did the changes. We coordinated some signals and added a couple of seconds to some movements, and that helped quite a bit. So on Broome Street between John Nolan and West and John Nolan and Wilson Street, there is a proposed raised shared use path, which is 10 feet wide from John Nolan to Wilson on the east side of Broome. At the intersection of Broome and Wilson, there is a channelized right turn lane. And what we did is we moved the island a couple feet to the west to make northbound only one lane, making the outmost lane only a right turn into West Wilson. And that is the wheel path for a single unit truck, or I believe it's a city bus, actually. Just showing that we kept that corner as tight as we could with that turning movement. Between Wilson and Doty, we reduced the northbound lanes to one, and that actually let us preserve three trees and fully separate the cycle track from the sidewalk for this block. And then at Doty, it transitions to an on-street cycle track where it's still separated from the sidewalk. And we also have a floating bus stop with a raised crossing for pedestrians, so they would be at the same level of the sidewalk when they're crossing over the cycle track and to the bus stop. Loading.
Gretchen, while we're waiting,
yes.
Does floating simply mean that you have to be standing on the bike lane in order to board the bus? Is that the main?
So what you would do, yes, the bus will stop at that floating bus stop, which is like a little island, and people would need to cross over the cycle track at that raised pedestrian crossing and then board right there.
Yeah, but you don't have to stand in the bike lane waiting for the bus to come.
Right.
It'll be an island.
That just means the bus doesn't come all the way over to where
to the curb.
People
right.
are waiting.
Correct. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so at West Wilson, at the 300 block, we are proposing this curb-to-curb, which allows for bike lanes, the conventional bike lanes, or the two-way cycle track. And this is how a typical section would look like and how we would mark it for the conventional bike lanes, so bike lanes both directions. The trees on the north side of Wilson are mostly ash trees, and those are being scheduled to be removed by forestry. So since most of them are removed and we need extra width at that location, so closer to the intersection of Henry and Hamilton, we are using that extra space, taking some feet off of that terrace. We are also bumping out the curb at Henry so vehicles can do that turning movement and safely arrive to that westbound lane on Wilson. And to be able to provide a 5-foot bike lane, we would also need to take some width out of that terrace on the south side, which eliminates one other tree, which wasn't scheduled to be removed by forestry. So near the intersection, this is how the curb-to-curb would look like. It would work for both conventional and the two-way cycle track. And this is how we would mark it for conventional bike lanes. That's it. Questions? Yes.
Gretchen, on going toward Broome on that section of Wilson Street, what's the origin of bicyclists? Are they coming down Wilson Street, or where are they coming?
Me right here. Oh, I can't see. Okay.
No, you're up at Hamilton.
Okay.
It's the Hamilton and Wilson intersection.
I'm trying to get out of the presentation so I can open up another PDF.
Okay.
Which would be easier.
Over there, yeah.
Here?
Are they crossing Hamilton from Wilson?
Right, so if we do the bike lanes over here, it would stop, and that would mean that they would have to go up Hamilton or Henry.
I ask another question?
Sure.
Was in this document where you were talking about the backups onto John Nolan?
Yeah.
How did, just tell us, can you tell us a little bit more about, is it, you say it was like within a 10 or 15 minute time frame that almost all the backups were in the morning?
Right, that's correct. So in the morning for 10 to 15 minutes every peak hour during the boarding peak hour, it would this movement right here, this right turn onto from Broome onto Wilson would have backups. They wouldn't go all the way to John Nolan, but they were significant. So what we did after that meeting, we actually gave eastbound Wilson a little bit more time. And after that, we have seen it improve, but it was also during the holiday week. So we need a couple more days to see how much that really improved. But we think that it improved quite a bit.
But
that queuing.
But it's not a backup where, let's see, people coming into the city on John Nolan, so they've just crossed the bridge. That left turn lane doesn't leave people just sitting there.
Waiting because of the backup? No, it's okay. Not. It doesn't go that far.
The right turn lane, but not
does,
the left
but
turn
not
lane.
The left.
Okay.
Okay, if there aren't any more questions, why don't we go to the public comments? So, Peter, I'm sorry, is it Toglia?
Oh, Taglia?
Taglia, sorry.
Taglia would be the correct Italian pronunciation, but I don't know. My dad, Taglia, so that's what it was.
Okay. So, wishes to speak, neither support nor oppose, and you have 3 minutes.
Thank you. So I live at 718 West Brittingham Place, which is right by Brittingham Park. So I'm like a block from the terminus of West Wilson. And my wife works at the DOA building. I work in my neighborhood. So she works on Wilson, and we bike, walk, and drive our car on Wilson. And if there was a frequent user rewards program for Wilson, I think we would be not at the top, but high up there. And so it is really important that the corridor study was done. And so I want to thank Transportation Department for doing a fantastic job. They had to respond to a lot of different comments, and I admit that some of them were from me. There were also, it's sometimes hard to get lots of people involved, and so my wife works at the DOA building, and there's a ton of bicyclists, people who bike there, who weren't notified when the property owner, the facility manager, had this. But nevertheless, we brought a lot of those people to the meeting, and there were a lot of really strong supports for making a large improvement to the bicycling, and I think staff did a great job of identifying why a cycle track is so important here. Having the separation is what allows a bicycle facility to reach more people, and we can't forget that we have the most popular bike path in the state, and then the most popular tourist destination in the state being the square connected right through this area. So I'll just speed it up. I think it's very important that we look at this and try to do it in the best way. One of my concerns, I urge you to do what the TPPB did and wait for the study to be complete. And I think that the support is there for the most separated bicycle facilities, cycle track. And there's one comment I'll have about that is the curb. If we set the curb now, it might preclude having a curb-separated bike path. And there's something important about having a curb-separated bike path, and that's infiltration. Bike paths, cycle tracks don't get the same amount of salt as the road does. So when you're thinking about the bike lanes on the road, it gets commingled with the runoff from the road, and a cycle track doesn't do that. So that's not always talked about, but since I'm a hydrogeologist, it's super important. The last thing I'll say is our neighborhood has worked on a lot of different efforts to increase bicycle planning and bike and ped support. So our neighborhood association did submit a comment in favor of cycle tracks. And on our neighborhood association agenda next week, we're going to be talking about the other things we can do that will connect up our neighborhood and District 13 with this. So I just want to thank you again, our Think Transportation, for putting together really good options. And I would really urge you to do the thing that will help keep us moving forward on bicycles and on separated facilities and on infiltration. So thank you.
So I think you thought that I knew what you, the issue of snow removal, mm-hmm. what's the best profile or whatever for that? Because if you have a totally separate track, then you have to wait for different equipment, right? Were you saying that if it is part of the lane, it's better in the winter?
I don't do the maintenance and know the equipment, but I know the water runoff flow patterns. And so when you have a bike lane right next to a road, it's more of the salt that gets into the entire roadway and all drains in one direction. If you have a curb separating a cycle track, then that curb is actually what separates the water, the runoff, mm-hmm. and that allows the cycle track to be pitched in a different way, and it allows you to be able to use things like rain gardens more effectively. So you can actually infiltrate water from roadways even in the winter, but you have to adjust the entry point, because if the salt, the chlorides in the salt can cause clays in the soil particles to lower the permeability. And it's really interesting. It sounds really nerdy, but our city has great resources, and the people who work on this, Phil Graber, I think, at engineering, they know all this stuff, but what's important is what's handed to them, like from you guys and from the other commissions, there is a difference in what they can do with it. And what they can do with the curb-separated cycle track is much better for infiltration in our lakes.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Harold, is it Cleans, 6 North Allen Street? Neither support nor opposed, wishes to speak.
Yeah, thank you. And I think, as you have already pointed out at the beginning of the meeting, this is a kind of a complicated matter. So I apologize in advance if I'm not getting right, like the corridor study versus the 300 block and TPPB and TC and all that. But I think I want to reinforce some of the points that Peter has made. I think the corridor study has been a great effort in trying to figure out what the trade-offs are in the Wilson Street corridor. And we have identified Wilson Street as this gateway to the square. There's a DOA. There are many other destinations. And so it really is a key destination for people in cars, for people biking, for people walking, for transit possibly as well. And so we really need to get this right. And the corridor study is the way to do that. And so I think what's on the table today is to not make a decision about like a small piece that is part that is affected by the corridor study before we actually know what the corridor study as a whole will make as a recommendation. So to me, that just makes common sense. Let's not make a decision now that locks us in for one block while we still don't know what the decision, like the cycle track or not cycle track, and I'm hoping that it will be a cycle track, is for the corridor study. So I really support not making decision now, and I'll let you deal with the procedural stuff with prejudice or without prejudice, but let's wait until we have figured out a corridor study before we make decisions for one block of Wilson Street. Thank you.
Anybody have any questions? Thank you. Next we have Thomas Wilson, 719 Clark Court. Neither support nor opposed, wishes to speak and is available to answer questions. Tom.
Hi. Thank you, Chairperson Kovich. So as many of you know, I also serve on the Transportation Policy and Planning Board. Just wanted to lend my support to the option of placing this on file without prejudice. I think that option gives the gives everyone the greatest amount of flexibility, and it sounds like with the construction being pushed off to 2020 that staff has indicated there is time to complete the study, and then there'll still be time to do the bidding process and get everything constructed. So if we have the opportunity to do that, I think we should take it. So I'm available for questions if anyone has any.
Anybody have any questions for Tom?
Thank you.
Okay, so thoughts. And Mike, did you have any comments that you wanted to make? Oh, Mike behind you there. Sorry.
Thank you, Ann.
Yes.
I'll try to be as concise as Tom was. I do have another meeting at 5:30, so I will do that for myself. To keep it very simple and sweet, I concur in the recommendation to place this item on file without prejudice. This item is only here because Alderperson Foster requested that the item be referred to you, all of you, by the Board of Public Works. So Alderperson Tierney saw this at the Board of Public Works. You weren't on the Board of Public Works at the time, or were you? I know you switched on and off the board, so you might not have been there at the time, excuse me. But in any event, that's how this came before you, and I respect Alderperson Foster's request to have the plans and specifications be seen by the Transportation Commission. But frankly, what that meant is that we ran out of time simply to have a reconstruction project this year. So the reality is the calendar is such and this public bidding process is such that we can't have a project this year in any event. So the real only alternative is to wait until next year's construction season at this point. And with that said, it thus makes total sense to try to attempt to complete the entire Wilson Street Corridor study if staff has the capacity to do so. I know that Transportation Director and Thomas here tonight, as you all see behind me, has expressed some concern that that might not be possible with the current staff and given the BRT study underway, but I hope that we can make it work so that the reconstruction can occur on the 300 block of West Wilson Street and South Broome Street early next year in the spring, because there has been a lot of uncertainty, as Bridget knows very well. And for those of you that don't know, she lives on the affected block. There have been an unprecedented number of water main breaks in the 300 block of West Wilson Street, which is why I worked hard to bump this up on the city engineering schedule and work to get a budget amendment adopted by the Common Council to allow for this project to go forward this year. Unfortunately, that's not to be, and I respect the rationale for why that can't happen, that we should take a thorough look at the entire corridor, something that we didn't have the time to do. And so with that, again, I would urge you tonight to respectfully place this matter on file without prejudice. Thank you.
Anybody have any questions for Alder Verrier?
So on that, I also spoke to the city engineer, Rob Phillips. From an engineering perspective at this point, engineering division is okay with if the commission decides to place on file without prejudice.
Thank you, Yang. Yeah. Thank you.
Grant?
I've moved to place it on file without prejudice.
Second.
There's a motion and a second. Further discussion?
Yeah.
Bridget, then Grant.
Okay. Yeah, so I support the motion. What I would like to see before I'm comfortable moving forward, not only for myself, I do live right there, but a lot of my neighbors have come to me with additional concerns, and I just want to voice those. So the presentation that we saw this evening showed a bike lane that could be considered
just on a cycle track. My understanding is that at the July 1 public meeting, that path or that separated facility was shown with bollards, which I didn't see in the plans that we just saw. So those are some of the concerns that I know some of us have, and we'd like to, I know I would like to see, if not a plan set, then something closer to a specific set of specifications for what the work that would take place, and including a signing and signalization plan. We do have a number of issues with signalization at the intersection there, and I'd like to make sure that you know, there are plans to resolve those issues. I also have some concerns with the project limits, which we haven't, I think, seen specifically, but to address Broome Street as it approaches John Nolan without dealing with the railroad crossing there brings me some concern that railroad crossing is problematic for a number of reasons, and understanding that Wisconsin Southern, who operates that rail line, which is owned by WISDOT, you know, they are certainly putting a lot of money in over at the other crossing at Machinery Row there, and so they probably would not be willing in the near future, but I would like that conversation to at least take place before moving forward. All of that said, I think that at least tabling until the corridor study is complete and we're able to see that and deal with some of the other issues is certainly the best course of action here. But I do want, I want to see the plan sets. I want to know that the drainage issues, which cause a lot of a lot of hazards right in front of my home, will be addressed, and I want to see specifically how they're addressed, among other issues that are potentially going to be taken care of. I'd also like to, at some point, potentially talk about, I guess, the case for adding a bicycle lane on the south side of Wilson Street, in that the traffic that we see on the sidewalk on the south side of Wilson is oftentimes not folks who are regular cyclists, and I'd like to be assured that adding the lane, we'll call it a cycle track or bike lane, will is something that all levels of bicyclists will feel comfortable using. And at this point, I don't feel comfortable that is the case. I don't know, you know, certainly at this point, given the city's ordinances, folks can ride on the sidewalk there. And if we have not only people riding on the sidewalk, but also people riding in the cycle track and then potentially also riding on the street, all of which would be legal, I don't know how far that gets us in being able to best manage all types of traffic, including pedestrian, for the entire neighborhood, as well as kind of the greater population that uses that area.
First, can I go back to Gretchen? Did we not see the same presentation that the Transportation Policy and Planning Board saw?
Yes, it's the same one.
So what was that point that you made, first, about it being different?
Yeah, so the July 1 public meeting.
At the Policy Board?
No, there was a public meeting last week, apparently, that a lot of my neighbors attended, and one of the concerns that they brought up was the plastic bollards that were shown.
Tom, no. you want to make any comments?
No. Okay. So whatever it was that was around them, they have seen representations, and these aren't, you know, bicycle infrastructure folks. So if they saw plastic bollards, they saw what they said is plastic upright thingies. That's what they saw. And yeah, Galen and yep, Grace. Yeah.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay. Oh, it was. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Thanks. Thanks for the clarification.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Yeah. And I just want to comment, something that we had conversation about at a prior Transportation Commission meeting, and it relates to your comment and wanting to see the plans and specs.
Mm-hmm.
According to the current ordinance, our jurisdiction is to review and approve the geometric design.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Tom Lynch and Yang and others have talked about and had conversations. We have some engineers, you know, you're an engineer, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not. But there's been some debate about what does that mean. But I just want to remind people that, you know, what's within our jurisdiction is the geometric design. So we may have some discussion about what constitutes geometric design, but that's what was within our current jurisdiction.
Yeah, to my view, that is part of the geometric design. At least so in my experience, and again, that's with the state and certainly not the city, but that is what we would consider part of the geometrics.
Well, Tom, do you want to address that? And then Grant, it'll be your turn. If you want to come up to a mic, that would be great.
Plan specifications and engineer's estimate, that's PS&E. You're at 100% design. So or 90%. So PS&E is, that's what I've done. So oftentimes 30% is used for, let's say, environmental documents. So 30%, you do not have specifications. 30%, you may have drainage, you may not. Drainage is normally considered like a 45% level, or often is considered a 45% level. So I think the idea is that you you don't want to be investing all the way to 100% or 90% if a plan isn't going to, or a geometry isn't going to be acceptable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it would be better if this body should have a greater level of detail than the TPPB. The TPPB should be the corridor plan. This body should have the geometry, not in fat lines, but in thin lines. But as far as the full plan set, I don't think. I'm going to say this. I'm going to turn around to Chris. Would you agree pretty much what I'm saying? Yeah. So it's going to be voted down. Let's not spend all the money to get it to 100%. You know?
And I think 30% it certainly would be fine with me. That would give enough detail to kind of know what the effect is on the ground. The plan that we have at this point just doesn't give enough detail.
Well, actually, I think in the back of the that memo,
the addendum,
mm-hmm. there was geometry, which is, now it may be a little small. If it's printed out on 11 by 17, it looks.
Gretchen, do you have that to put up on the?
Yep.
Yeah. So this, if you go to, I think if you were to go to these sheets, now these sheets should be 11 by 17, so they look a little small.
Mm-hmm.
And even on 11 by 17, and we're just going to admit,
mm-hmm.
It could be a little bit larger. But this provides the type of detail where you understand the truck turning movements, those types of things. So perhaps I would agree maybe this could be larger, but this would be a level of detail that I think is kind of appropriate for this. Now, this level of detail would be, I suspect, too much for the TPPB. The
mm-hmm.
TPPB should be dealing with kind of the concepts, the plans.
Which is what I have right there.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, so just for example, there's no scale on any of the plans and...
Yep, that could help.
Yeah.
I agree. Yeah.
A couple quick things. One, to Commissioner Streit, the question around kind of winter maintenance. So one of the, I think, big opportunities in front of us by voting in favor of the motion and waiting for the corridor study to be completed is if the recommendation is to have a cycle track here, what we can do instead of what would happen today, which is set some curbs and then later using paint and plastic bollards, depending on the solution, put standard bike lanes or a bollard protected cycle track, as we have the option then of doing a curb protected cycle track. And those two functionally have some pretty important differences related to winter maintenance. So okay. You can talk more about that if and when that recommendation comes up, but there are some real significant differences, both in terms of infiltration, but maybe even more importantly, just the ability for our streets department to keep those clear and ice free. The other point I wanted to make is I really agree with Commissioner Brown that I think a lot of the confusion around this, one, started with the Transportation Commission receiving the interim recommendation. In my opinion, that never should have come to us. That always should have gone to the TPPB, and I think that started some of the confusion around, hey, wait, didn't we see this already? Didn't we approve the geometry? And I think that really set us on a course to not quite understand what have we done, what should we be doing. Alder Revere mentioned that, you know, part of the delay to this is that I asked this to be referred from Board of Public Works, this being the plans and specs, to the Transportation Commission. I expect that should happen on all of these major projects.
That has not been the case, no.
Can I finish talking? Thank you. That has been the history of how this has happened through the Ped Bike Motor Vehicle Commission. And during the TORC process and the reevaluation, the reconfiguration, that work that's described as geometry was moved to the Transportation Commission. And I think this is a conversation we'll get into in more depth when we have perhaps our joint meeting, and if there's a need to clarify the current resolution, we can do that. I feel very strongly that we should have something that's basically fully baked coming here that we're reviewing, that we're asking detailed questions on, and that we're approving or not. The question of 30%, that was explicitly addressed at Ped Bike several years ago, and for very big projects like University Avenue, tonight we're going to get a kind of a preliminary look. Our specific ask then as Ped Bike Motor Vehicle Commission was, we want to see these big projects at 30% as the starting point, not as an ending point, so that there's an opportunity for questions, an opportunity for dialogue, an opportunity to go back, make alterations, and so ultimately together with staff and with the commission, we're getting to a plan that is approved and that moves forward. And that's what I would like to see, and that's my expectation on this body. So. I get the challenges with all this, but the idea that this would have only gone to Board of Public Works and would not have received approval from the Transportation Commission, I think that was an error, and I think it's something we really do need to address in our joint meeting with the Transportation Policy and Planning Board. I do also agree with Tom Lynch that we need to have some clarity around what is the level that the Transportation Policy and Planning Board deals with things, AKA the corridor study, and what is the level of detail that transportation deals with things. And in my opinion, again, that would be a mostly fully baked version of what is going to get constructed. So understanding how that process works and confirming if that is the role of this body seems like really important work. But in terms of the motion in front of us, I support moving to place on file without prejudice and hope everyone else supports that as well.
My point I just wanted to make was to repeat where we are today. It doesn't mean that we can't consider changing the, you know, current ordinance in order to make the responsibilities of the Transportation Commission different. But there also is still opportunity for discussion about what constitutes geometric design. And what level of completion you know, gets us to that point. But according to the current ordinance, that's what's within the scope of our jurisdiction right now, unless other things are referred to us. And if things are referred to us, then, you know, we need to have need to take the opportunity to review them. So, but that is a topic that's on our agenda for the joint meeting, and certainly one where we've had tons of discussion and we'll continue to have tons of discussion. So other discussion with regard to the motion, Ken?
Just one, Gretchen, my understanding is you will continue now through the summer and maybe the fall to do other kind of pilots or check out different things, or are you sort of done with the thing of putting in temporary lane closures or whatever you were doing the first time when you looked at this? It sounded like you thought it was maybe worth continuing to do these different kind of experiments.
So what we did, we were observing, we're observing the different traffic patterns or traffic behavior if we reduce two lanes to one.
Okay.
And we already have quite a bit of information on that. So it's not like we would need to do something too different.
Okay.
We're just looking at the lane configuration and how that would impact the intersection and the signals.
Other comments or questions? Okay, we have a motion and a second before us. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Any abstentions? Motion carried. Okay, thank you, Gretchen.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Thanks, everybody. A lot of work, a lot of discussion, and a lot of back and forth on those two companion resolutions. Next, we have University Avenue Geometrics. You guys would introduce yourselves just to remind everybody, please.
Jerry Schiffer with City Madison Traffic Engineering.
Chris Petikowski, City Engineering. Let me just pull up our file here. Sorry, I'm not sure why it's not reading the. Can pull it off the Legistar though. So, again, my name is Chris Petikowski. I'm with City Engineering. We've been working for a few months now on the University Avenue project. It's a joint project that we're working on with the Village of Shorewood Hills. The village owns basically the north half of the right-of-way from our limits, and the city of Madison owns the south half of the limits. So jointly working with Shorewood on developing this project, we did apply for federal funds for this and were awarded 60% federal funds for the roadway items. We've been working on a design, meeting with some stakeholders, and most recently in June, had a PIM, and I'm going to kind of give a brief recap of that PIM, and then kind of we can walk through the first draft of the road layout. So, project overview, we are proposing to reconstruct University Avenue from Hill Street or Shorewood Boulevard to University Bay Drive or Farley Avenue. They have different names on the different sides of the street. It'll be a full reconstruction with pavement, curb and gutter, sidewalk as needed, storm sewer, sanitary sewer, and water main, and lighting and signals. So what are some of the project needs? Why are we doing the project? There's a poor pavement condition. It's rated a 3 out of 10 right now, which is 3 or 4. I forget. Which is among the worst of our alternatives, arterial streets. They usually don't get down. I think it's a 4. They can get down that low. We have some substandard roadway geometrics with a large hill that doesn't have quite the sight distance that a modern street reconstruction would. We don't have any bicycle accommodations on the street. There's no sidewalk on the north side of the street existing now. Looking at trying to improve safety and ped and bike accommodations, as well as stormwater is a big issue on this project. So this street floods on a pretty much yearly basis. 1 to 2 year storm will flood the street and stop all traffic. And being next to the hospital and emergency room, that's a big problem, and also causes a lot of damage, property damage. So right now, the University Avenue has an existing typical section of 3 12-foot lanes in each direction. As I mentioned, there is no sidewalk on that north side. It only exists on the south side, on the Madison side. It is a very heavily traveled street, one of the top 3 in the state, between 50 and 60,000 cars a day. So when we went to the PIM, we've been working on a number of alternatives of what we could do here. We kind of put down our first draft and tried to get public input on it. By no way is this our proposed final design. What we really tried to do here is put something on paper so that people can react and have public or get that public input on it. So what are the things we looked at? We have about 105 feet of right-of-way to work with. There are a lot of buildings that are uptight to the right-of-way, so there's not a lot of opportunities to buy right-of-way to expand. There's the railroad on the north side, so that's an absolute, no expansion on the north side in some areas. We've looked at maintaining the traffic lanes, looking at left turn lanes, maybe improving some of those left turn lanes. We've looked at putting on bicycle lanes. Looking at sidewalk on the north side, look at multi-use path options. We're also trying to take into consideration that this is going to be a future BRT route proposed in DOT to run a BRT along this corridor. So we want to keep that in mind and make sure that the street operates and is designed in a way that it wouldn't and need any reconstruction once that BRT goes into system and starts in existence. So this was our proposed like I said, our first draft design. Right now there were, as I mentioned, six 12-foot lanes, which are one of the first things we can do usually is look to thin the lane width and see if that can afford some opportunities to do some other things with the cross section. So what we're showing here is two 11-foot driving lanes and a 10 in each direction. In some areas, we've gone down to all 10-foot driving lanes. In this case, there's one thing we have to keep in mind is with BRT being there, a 10-foot lane doesn't work real well for the BRT. So we want to provide that. We were proposing here to keep an 11-foot driving lane for BRT as well as National Highway. Since it is the National Highway on the National Highway system, and we are using federal highway funds, you need to have, with the amount of traffic and truck traffic we have on this street, we need to keep at least a 11-foot driving lane for that as well. So,
Chris, just looking. So on this, mirror to mirror, that's 11 on that truck. That is that. The maximum for a truck is 11 feet. It looks like it's just touching the walls.
Yeah, that is a just a graphic. It's not an an actual. But there are buses that have mirror to mirror 11. And there are trucks that will have mirror to mirror 11. Not necessarily all of them though.
Okay.
We looked at wider terraces. One of the things. We've heard along the way is that it's not a very pleasant pedestrian experience, so what are the things that make that better? That having sidewalk everywhere obviously makes it a better pedestrian experience. Having a bigger terrace and a place for a tree canopy to try to get that separation from the traffic is something that we were looking at with this proposal. Elsewhere in the area, so you might look at this typical section and say, well, where's the bike accommodations? City of Madison always puts bike accommodations in. So this is kind of one of the trade-offs we're working with on this project. So there is a proposed improvement. Village of Shorewood Hills is installing a 10-foot multi-use path along the north side of the railroad corridor here. So about 60 feet away from the street. So that will be installed this summer, this 10-foot multi-use path. And that will go from Marshall Court down to University Bay. And it already exists from Marshall Court up to Hill Street. So within our project limits, there is a 10-foot wide multi-use path, or there's a short run of very bikeable Purdue Street right next to the project. So one of the things we were looking at was, well, maybe we should really just focus on, getting people across and to that path and really trying to, enhance the pedestrian experience by creating that sidewalk on the north side and given a little more space to terraces. So that was just like I said, our first draft at it. I'll also show one thing that we are proposing to look into or implement with the project is an overpass or underpass of University Bay Drive. So right now that multi-use path exists on the east side of this street at U Bay. It just stops right at U Bay. That's the campus, some people call it the campus drive path. That exists today. The path on the west side of the street will exist as of this fall. And we were proposing with this project to potentially look at getting an overpass or underpass with the project. So that's kind of in our scope of the project. As far as Metro Transit accommodations, we have some areas with bus stop pullouts. We're working with Metro staff to move some of the bus stops to far side intersections so that they can be a little more efficient and not have to wait for that red light. And then some of the bus stops we would propose to remain in place. As far as BRT, you know, this is one of the planned first routes, possibly a station at University Bay Drive and maybe Shorewood Boulevard. So we're kind of not necessarily would we build the station with the project, but want to make sure that if it does get built, it wouldn't need any reconstruction of the street. So some of the things we're looking at is how to give them some signal priority, how to maybe create some bypass lanes with the project so that they can kind of run alongside of some of the queues and get past the queues to keep that BRT running smoothly. One of the things that BRT is looking at is running on shoulders on campus drive. So how would this project tie into that, and how would those buses, you know, align to get themselves over to campus drive on the shoulders? So we're going to continue to coordinate with them. So that was just this is just a BRT route, and here's our project area. As I mentioned, the watershed is a big deal. Currently University at Sherwood Boulevard and University at Midvale and at Farley or U Bay flood quite often, almost yearly. We would like to, with this project, especially anywhere the roadway is being reconstructed, make sure we're planning for the right solution there to try to do the best we can to handle some of those flood issues. And some of our first line of thinking was that there would be a big stormwater box, a new stormwater box under this stretch of pavement. Some of our modeling has shown that potentially an even better option could be to create a new tunnel from the Midvale Boulevard intersection right directly to the lake to the north. So we might look at using that money that we were potentially you know, considering for the pipe under the street to go towards the pipe that might go directly out to the lake. In particular, we're finding that geometry for the storm sewer is a lot more effective than being under the street and would help with the flooding a lot more. So all things that we're going to kind of continue to keep working on. Project schedule, we are
right now in just kind of a 30% level, going out to the public, trying to get input. We would hope to kind of towards the fall, kind of gather all that input, start to work on a little more refined set of plans, and start to work on our environmental document that's required for the federal funds, and another public input meeting probably this fall to show where we're at. Then over the winter and the next summer, look at starting, you know, after that second public input meeting and making sure we're on the right track, start to work on the final plans. And right now we have currently slated 2021 for construction. We have our website up that has all the information. And let me just jump here now. I'll just kind of quickly, where did I go? Just jump through the actual plan display that we showed. And then if time allows, I can talk about some of the input we heard at the public input and our public input meeting and kind of show you some of the major things we heard at the PIM.
We saw one of the emails that was forwarded to us from
Robbie Wiper.
Thank you. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Chris, when you talked about the hill and the sight line, are you mainly talking the Bagels Forever swimming pool?
Yes.
Area right there?
That is the hill, yep. I don't see a way to zoom here. Sorry, this is not my normal computer. There's no way to pan.
The map is on the plus.
This one? Yeah, it just kind of zooms in where it wants to, though. I can't go sideways. But I apologize. I had a PDF here ready to show. Maybe if there we go.
Try clicking in the Data 1F drive.
All right, thank you.
Oh, okay, gotcha.
All right, sorry about that. Okay, let's move on here.
We're all being watched.
I guess.
Okay, I'll zoom in on the western end here. Again, just creating those six lanes, a new sidewalk on the north side of the street proposed, and the new wider terraces. This area I'll talk about in a minute. We're showing at Schmidt Place. To right now, this is currently an open intersection. We propose to close the median. We'll have more discussion on that in a minute. At Ridge Street and Marshall Court, we had done an interim improvement here maybe about 6 or 7 years ago or so to create this kind of half signal and pedestrian crossing. So we're at this point we're proposing to widen these sidewalks to allow for bikes and more pedestrians to be able to use that a little easier, and then connecting up to the new multi-use path on the north side here, as well as having this sidewalk connection now, the new far side metro bus stop, and a new sidewalk connection up to the pool area.
Christine, is there an existing crossing of the railroad right there, or would you guys have to petition OCR?
So there is a crossing on the east side, but not the west side. And, so we'd have to this whole project is going to require going to the OCR and kind of getting a new permit to cross at these locations.
So the crossing is there, but the sidewalk is not?
Right now there's a crossing here, just like this. It's a little smaller. There's a sidewalk up tight against the road right now.
Okay.
But so we're proposing a wider separated path to kind of tie into the new Shorewood path system.
Okay.
And a new sidewalk here on this side that doesn't exist right now. Okay. That's weird. Moving to the east, continuing that cross section, as I mentioned, a new U-turn location here. That was a little bit to help with alleviate with the issue of the Schmidt Place median opening being removed. As we get to University Bay, I have a number of things going on here. So there was a study done jointly by the city, UW, and Village of Shorewood Hills a few years ago proposed some improvements to this area. One of the improvements that they looked at was a double left here, because right now this single left turn in the morning backs up almost all the way to Bagels Forever-ish area. Yep.
Anytime there's a train there.
Anytime there's a train, that'll probably still continue to happen. But even every cycle in the morning, it backs up quite a bit.
Yeah.
So we propose a double left here, and then continuing that double left, those two lanes up north to it, because if you add a double left, you have to have two lanes to receive them as well. So proposing that to go up to the north here for a ways till there's enough time for people to merge together. A new bus pullout here for Metro. Right now they park in the lane there and use that as a time stop, and that creates a lot of congestion and people trying to drive around the bus. So one of the really key things I think that we're proposing is putting this bus stop that currently exists near side on the far side. And with so doing that, really enhancing this crossing here, widening it, Continental Crossing, adding pedestrian leading time. So before the green, there's a walk symbol for any cars. And then continuing that sidewalk up on the north, or up to the north along the west side, all the way to where it exists currently. Right now, from this point to the south, there is no sidewalk on the east side of this of University Bay Drive. So we're proposing to. Has long been kind of an issue with the village of Shorewood and the hospital and trying to get this sidewalk in, proposing to do that with this project. There is a, as I mentioned, a bus bypass lane right here, and so that is allows the buses to get through the get around the congestion and get through the intersection and into their pullout here. So that's kind of the plans quickly. And I'll just got a couple more slides from the of feedback from the PIM. So we heard a lot of comments. It was very well attended. I'd say almost maybe 100 people. Heard a lot of different comments, and there was kind of four maybe themes that I was hearing. One is pedestrian and bike crossings. So how do we get people across the street safely? As I mentioned, this is our kind of first draft at it, and some of the things we're hoping to do is enhance these crossings, try to work with the signals to try to get some advance time for peds to cross, and make them wide, make them visible. But there is no getting around that you're crossing a street that carries 50 to 60,000, and it's not always easy to do. So as I mentioned, widened crossings. A lot of people ask, like, well, you're proposing a bridge over U Bay Drive east west. Why not north south? There's a couple of reasons we can't do that. There's already an existing stormwater box underneath that runs along the street. There would be no way to tunnel underneath University Avenue because that stormwater box is in the way. Also, with the railroad has different rules as far as bridging over the railroad. So you need, 25 feet, roughly, 23-25 feet to get over the railroad, and by the time you do that, your ramp is so far long, it's just not even feasible to get an overpass over this area. So we're stuck at surface level for crossing University Avenue, I'm afraid. But as I mentioned, we're hoping to, with the signals and widening crossings and any other ideas that folks may have, we're willing to hear it. The next comment was, well, you don't have any bike accommodations on the project. And as I mentioned, we had looked at utilizing that path on the north side of the street, but some of the comments were, well, how do we, I want to get to places on the south side of the street. How do we do that? And there's a number of ways we could do that. You know, we could look at bike lanes on the street. We didn't propose that because the last section we built of University Avenue to the west does have bike lanes. We took those all those 12-foot lanes and scrunched them down to 11s to get bike lanes on each side. But really, those bike lanes haven't been, as you guys all know, having a bike lane against a 50,000 car street, it's not the way we should be moving forward. So we didn't propose the bike lanes. One thing I'm showing here that we could look at potentially that Jerry was looking into and help seeing if we could maybe fit in is there a way to get some bikes on the south side of the street, and how would we do that? One way we might look at doing that is, scrunching up the terraces more, scrunching up the sidewalk on the north side a little more, and implementing a multi-use path on that south side. So then you what are some of the trade-offs there? You don't have the sidewalk, quite the same sidewalk width on the north. You don't have, the bigger terraces. You would lose a number of trees.
Would you be able to get a 10-foot in there? Or would you have to go for an exception? Or?
I'm not sure. A 10-foot could fit.
You think?
It comes at cost, right? Yeah. So you'd probably have no trees on the street. At that point, we're showing kind of the minimum. The tree that we're showing is could only really be an ornamental tree. It wouldn't be a very big tree, but it is a tree nonetheless. If we went to 10, we'd probably be looking at just a terrace with no trees. So about 9 is probably about the biggest we could fit. There are a number of driveways. But people do bike on the sidewalk now. Jerry's been looking at the cameras. There is some bikers on the sidewalk. So, a nine foot path, I don't think it would require an exception. The absolute minimum they allow is 8. So we would, but this is something we could look at doing if people were interested.
Chris, I think anecdotally, the riders that I know that are coming from the west, they, because of Hill Street, the lanes are stopping, what they have done is they basically take the path served up by the office building, and they move to the north side of the street back there.
Mm-hmm.
So until there would be a continuation opportunity going past Smokies and all that kind of stuff, that's I think where they do that, because they don't find that the Hill Shorewood is a convenient intersection for them to move over, and that, or they go up to Regent Street and take the Shorewood Road, Shorewood or Regent and Bluff. There's a share or a bike path kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't cross Midvale because they know they're going to have to then deal with the Hill intersection.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yep.
So I'm saying if there was a continuation, you might see more
bikers
going past,
no doubt.
Blackhawk and all that kind of stuff. But right now they've already.
So maybe some of the people that aren't biking on the lanes are doing that because they know it stops.
Yeah, they bail out early. They bike, but they just don't use that stretch.
Yep. One of the things we did hear very favorably on was the presence of the sidewalk on the north side. I think we've heard a number of a lot of positive comments on that. So, looking at how do we try to fit in the most we can on this cross section. you know, if we didn't have the that extra 5 feet of sidewalk on the north side, you could maybe do even a little bit more bigger system on the south side, but the sidewalk was very popular. Not to mention, I should remind everyone that the roadway is half ours, so it's a joint decision with, you know, we got to come together with Shorewood Hills and make a decision, so we can't just kind of place everything on the south side and just leave the, you know, we have to work collaboratively with the village.
Grant has a question. Hmm?
So on that question, would Shorewood be responsible for maintenance then of that proposed sidewalk since it's on the north side?
Yep.
I guess that is a question I'd be interested in digging into just a little bit more. I know it was mentioned in the comment we received from Robbie Weber, but as I was looking at it, I wonder, I don't know if you have any more details on the comments that were received in favor of it, but I'm in my mind, I'm wondering to what degree is the desire for that because there isn't the connected path also right now. In other words, the plan is to this summer build the kind of connect that path on the north side, mm-hmm. which is on the north side of the railroad tracks. And I'm wondering, as I look at everything, there are zero destinations other than two bus stops. There's really nowhere that you would walk to and from on that north side that would be better than using the new path that will be there, which is actually adjacent to all the destinations. And so I'm trying to understand what the value is of that sidewalk once there is the shared use path on the side of the railroad track that people walking would want to use, because there, like I said, there's the bus stop, you know, after U-Bay, which is really just at the corner. So I think really easily people could walk up onto that shared use path and in fact would need to do that in order to get across the railroad tracks there, and then there's just nothing else until you get all the way down to the western extent of the project. And even there, I mean, with the current development, it's just a massive parking lot, and so the sidewalk would take you to a parking lot where you're going to kind of walk through. And I mean, it seems like you could essentially access it on foot just as easily and I think a lot more nicely by using that shared use path. So I guess I do kind of question what the perceived value of that sidewalk on the north side is, you know, especially just considering it's it'll need to be maintained. And in terms of using it for like a recreational facility for walking, I mean, to walk right adjacent to 6 to 9 lanes of car traffic as opposed to being 20 feet away on the other side of the railroad tracks just doesn't. So maybe that's something. I don't know if you have any details about the nature of some of those supportive comments of it or.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's the Shorewood Shopping Center on the, let's see if I got this, on the far west end of the project. So there's, and, you know, as projects have been redeveloping, that they've been fronting the street. Right now there is a parking lot in front of it, but there is a shopping center that acts. So definitely on the west end, I think it has a little more utility. On the eastern end, you know, there's I think it's certainly up for debate. But, you know, all I can say is that It was quite popular, but yeah, maybe things might change if the path is there. I don't know. There's
Gary has a
point. I mean there's possible connection with the Sherwood Pool.
Yeah,
there is the shopping area where you have the True Food and the UPS store. I mean, there are destinations. They're kind of spread out, not really. You know, may not make a day of it to walk the whole thing, but that's maybe one thing that people would support. I don't know, but with that sidewalk, that's on the Shorewood side, and they're committed to building and maintaining it. Is that my understanding?
Well, they're at the same point we are. They're you know, public input phase, and they support it, and they would maintain it. Yeah.
In theory, they're supportive. And then, if I may, kind of a different question concerning Shorewood, since they are a partner in this venture, does that partnership extend to helping us provide updated bus stops and amenities at bus stops? Is there any commitment to that, or is that down the road?
I know that they've been in discussions with Metro about that in the past. I don't know the exact details, but they've partnered with Metro, and I believe fund a portion of Metro as well.
Did Chuck come to the table?
What was the question again?
Yeah, it's concerning the extent of the partnership here for this project, whether that partnership extends to helping us financially with the new bus stops or improving the ones that you will keep on the north side that you're not moving.
So within the project, they would be all rebuilt with the project.
Right. Okay. Okay. But,
and that would be all part of the cost share with the village.
Okay.
And just in general, they are a... they're not a full partner of Metro. They're a partial partner.
I know.
They have improved their contribution to Metro over the last several years. As was pointed out, that whole stretch along University Avenue where we have literally hundreds of buses going through per day, per weekday, they are probably up to paying about a fifth of what they should be, but that's like three times more than what they paid for 10 years ago. So they had some issues with the tax levy cap, and they're trying to gradually get up to their appropriate share.
Okay, that helps.
So for the sidewalk, so over the years, there's a couple of things that I heard from the neighbors and also from the railroad that I thought might be useful information. So I hear from some users, actually they're not living in Shorewood but in the city, is that they took a bus, got dropped off by the shelter by UFB Drive, and they want to cross street and go south, but they found that it's much easier to do it at the improved intersection at Ridge, so they walk along there that way, and then cross Ridge. So that's kind of one use for that, in addition to the destinations on Shorewood side. Actually, there is a GO trail right now, if you look. Right. So a second thing actually is from the railroad. They are very concerned about the
trespass.
Correct, yeah. So if no sidewalk, folks are less likely going to walk along the grass. They pretend to cross railroad wherever they are. So a couple of pieces of information might be helpful.
Grant, were you done with your comments earlier?
I had a few other questions.
Sure, go ahead.
Thank you. And thanks, Ian, for that. And I think that, you know, where my question on the sidewalk was going is, I think that's partly because of the absence of the path. So that, you know, once that path is there, is the value of that sidewalk still there? But so that's maybe something to look into. My other questions were, one, just in terms of kind of our complete streets resolution and the big picture stuff that we're supposed to be doing in terms of shifting mode share to walking, biking, transit, et cetera. When we have a project like this that currently carries such a high volume of motor vehicle traffic, I think it's probably pretty obvious for the engineers why we're proposing to, you know, continue to have six lanes plus turn lanes, you know, up to eight or nine lanes at an intersection. But I, you know, in conversations I've had with Tom Lynch, I think particularly if we're going to recommend a cross-section that doesn't meet the complete streets concept. And so in this case, perhaps we won't have bike facilities. You know, maybe that's the end result. I think it would be really helpful to just have as part of the presentation, here's an alternative where we go down to four lanes plus turn lanes or something, and here's the impact that would have on motor vehicle throughput. You know, I think for many folks that are in this business, you just say, oh, well, that'd be catastrophe, and it would be, you know, it would increase queues to whatever. But I think particularly if we're going to recommend something that is leaving something out, I think it would be helpful to explain why and sort of what's the level of congestion that would occur, so that we have something to kind of base that decision on. My other kind of question is related to BRT. So you mentioned this is kind of one of this is the West Corridor. In the BRT work, it was sort of an open question around dedicated lanes versus shared. It looks like based on this recommendation, there's no alternative that shows a dedicated BRT lane. So it sounds like the recommendation is definitely not consider a dedicated BRT lane on the university corridor. Was that looked at all, or just sort of again out of hand? There's no way to do that without really affecting deeply the car movements.
So we did talk about that, and Jerry can look. He did actually look at the modeling of it. What we were proposing here was to do a shared lane now, keep it 11 feet wide so that it could be a BRT lane in the future if something changes. But what we're seeing with the modeling and the flows, the traffic flows we have now, is that we would not be able to dedicate a dedicated bus lane without some pretty, pretty major traffic impacts.
So maybe just sharing that out as part of the next public meeting or next mm-hmm. time you come back here, kind of here's what that modeling showed and here's why we're recommending that. Question on the lane width, you kind of talked a little bit about the 10 versus 11 and the highway piece. It looks like the recommendation right now is two 11s and a 10. Is there any insight you can provide as to why that instead of two 10s and an 11?
So, again, that was... To keep a little bit of flexibility, so we are required to have at least one 11, and then if we in the future wanted to have that outside lane as a BRT lane, that would need to be 11 as well. So that was the reasoning that we were at where we're at. But I think let's see, what did we propose? Something a little bit different on this 10, 11, 10 and a half. So. You know, I'd say that still, you know, that was the reasoning is why there was two 11s and 10s.
Makes sense.
Or one 10 for now.
Two other quick questions. One is, I think there was a slide that said, you know, if we don't have bike accommodations on the south side of university, we would look at as kind of alternative streets for bike.
Actually, I've got a couple more slides.
Oh, okay, great. Because I didn't quite understand that one. And maybe as you're getting there, then my last question is going to be around some of the side streets. So, you know, while this project obviously is for University Avenue, it includes kind of the beginnings of a lot of those side streets, particularly to the south. And in some ways, that'll set the potential and the geometry for those streets into the future as well. So maybe more of a comment on that is maybe that's something that could be looked at to evaluate those streets, particularly around the bike accommodations question.
Yep.
And for streets like Farley and Franklin and those sorts of things, if we're not recommending adding any bike facilities, why that would...
Yeah, that's exactly what I was going to say on this slide. If we wanted to go to the more pedestrian model and focus on you know improving the pedestrian experience and leave the bike accommodations to the multi-use path on the north side, maybe we should focus on trying to create a route through here, basically one block off that goes east-west very nicely for bikes and pedestrians as well. Right now. I'm not sure how to get the mouse on. There it goes. Right now there's Harvey Street. Currently has got a kind of a mixed match of sidewalk as things have developed, but we could look at, you know, improving that over time, over the next few years. It's actually in some of our Reconstruct Streets program to look at that. Right now there's Harvey Street ends and there's a little alley that gets you over to Franklin, I believe. And then there's another alley that stops, but you know, maybe there's a potential to try to enhance some of these alleys to create them a little more bike friendly, and actually connect through to get over to Stephen Street, or maybe it's just enhancing you know, Franklin and getting over to Stevens, but this was just an idea. You know, maybe we should try to, if we do not include bike accommodations on University, maybe we should kind of try to mimic what Shorewood did on the north, on the south, and have something kind of parallel east-west through that route. Yep.
The other thing would be to do Harvey, and then where you have lights crossing, you know, the brand new three-story,
mm-hmm.
direct them north at that point, because you already have a path.
Yep.
And then just jump them over to that path, and especially if you would get into a thing where you'd have a bridge or a protected crossing going past Shorewood, there'd be a lot of people who would, be glad to pull off, like around the Blackhawk, go down Harvey, and then jump over again, as opposed to trying to squeeze something sure. past that Smokies.
Yep.
I mean, you just don't have room.
Yeah,
at Smokies right. and yep. Bagels River.
Right.
If I could just clarify that on that last point. So that all sounds good. I would say, you know, a similar concept was put forward with Monroe Street when we decided to not add accommodations there, and I don't think we've done anything since that construction project. So if that is really the plan, I would like to see something more deliberate and concrete about that, rather than saying, let's not worry about it here, we'll deal with it later. So it's kind of a note. And then the other thing is, when I was talking about the side streets, I actually mean looking at like Franklin and Farley, for example, and it looks like those are part of this project, at least the beginnings of those streets, and doing some
just really the curb return. Yeah.
Right, which, I mean, I think, you know, it's kind of critical, obviously, if we were going to want to put bike lanes on Farley, for example, or on Franklin, I think this would be the moment to see what that would look like and how that would work with the curb lines that are proposed. So that, I guess, the ask is to look at some of those streets and look at some of the traffic volumes on them and see if there is a way, or if there's a need to better accommodate bike accommodations on those streets where we'll have the curb work done at the intersections.
Chris?
Yeah, so I have some concerns about the thinking on pedestrian crossings. This might have come up at the public meeting. Could you go to the Marshall Court intersection? I think it's one of the slides.
Hey, Chris.
Yeah. So one of the experiences I'm really familiar with is trying to cross a road like this to get a bus when you're, you know, maybe not running on time. And I imagine you're already seeing, if you were to go out, you could observe pedestrians probably in the situation where they're trying to catch a bus and running out of time, and probably don't follow the don't walk signal as it is. And the reason I wanted to pull up the Marshall Court intersection is because it looks like it, when moving the bus stop to the front of the curb.
Sorry, you're not seeing the screen. I'm seeing it. I apologize.
It's okay.
I don't know why.
I'm moving the bus stops to the front of the curb. So imagine someone coming from the north side trying to catch an eastbound bus and now has to cross southwest and then east again. So I can imagine with the cycle lengths you're thinking that that could easily be 3 to 5 minutes to do that under the worst situations. And trying to do that in a hurry, I imagine that you could probably see now people running across the road to try and catch a bus, and I worry that that might make a situation like that worse. And I know trying to balance the traffic flow with pedestrian crossings is tricky, but I think it's a safety issue that can't be ignored probably.
Chuck, do you have complaints at that intersection right now?
In a little bit, you're going to hear from some of our staff who can actually talk about specific instances they've had. But I would say this is one of our focal points is dealing with bus stops and safe crossing. And we work with Yang and traffic engineering regularly to say, what do we do? Do we move bus stops? Do we eliminate bus stops on the north side because of this issue of lack of sidewalks and dangerous crossing? So, yes, it is a general issue, and I think you're trying to improve this with the plan, and it remains to be seen, you know, how our staff used those improvements. But I'm encouraged by this direction.
Yeah, and this bus stop location was put here by Metro. So we did show this to Metro and got their feedback. So they were able to add their input to that.
I think generally, it's just still it's worth considering, like, what is the trade-offs of no more than a 90-second cycle? What for the sake of pedestrians being able to cross in a timely manner, what's that going to cause? Like Alder Foster mentioned, what's going to be the trade-offs of doing that?
I use this intersection almost daily, so I'm kind of an expert. But one of the good things about this one is you almost never have to wait to cross these two legs. So really, the only time you're waiting for the signal is to get across the one time. So that does help a little bit, but the point's a good one, maybe this is an area where we would consider not doing a far side bus stop to just keep that closer to the crossings and have a near side bus stop in this case.
I mean, I think like leading intervals and stuff like that will help too.
Mm-hmm.
In my recollection, is our staff asked for it to be a far side stop.
Correct.
So far side stops are better for us in general. So I would not change it back if that's what our staff recommended. I would just say in terms of rushing things as a bus passenger also, both crossing East Washington to get to the number 6. Over 13 years of using the 6, I used to run across the street once in a while, having turned 60 a couple years ago. I don't do that anymore. And when I'm riding, even on a slower street like Monroe, there are people, if they don't allow time, then they're going to occasionally miss the bus stop. And some of our drivers, if they have time, will wait and look for those individuals. But you just begin to build in the crossing time. If you're going to ride the bus and you want to make sure that 99.9% of the time you're not going to miss the bus. And fortunately here there's lots of service, so you have choices, but anyway.
Did we get all your points, Grant? Okay. Other comments, questions?
Bridget? Yeah, I just wanted to circle back quickly to something that you had said about talking a little bit about the potential for a multi-use separated path. So it had been shown, I think, on the drawing as a 9-foot. So my familiarity is the 10-foot minimum, and you had talked about an 8-foot, and I'm just curious where that comes from.
So I can maybe I'm incorrect in that, but I've in dealings with federal funds on a project in the past through WISDOT, we have been able to neck it down into 8 foot in certain areas, but
that's an exception. So the ASHTO standard in the Wisconsin Bicycle Facility Design Handbook requirement is 10 foot. So just FYI, it can be an exception down to potentially 8 feet, but 10 foot is the standard minimum.
If 9 is unacceptable, then, you know.
Bridget actually is correct. Yeah, so the minimum with the current standards is a 10. With exception for situations, it's okay to reduce to 8. But those really should be used where you have no other alternatives. For this one, this might be one of those examples. Also, I think, there's a lot of emphasis on this is really a wide sidewalk, not really.
It doesn't have enough separation correct. From the roadway to actually right. even be considered a multi-use path, technically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, I just want to make sure that, the goal is always to kind of meet the minimum standard, and if an exception is needed, then that's okay, but just understanding that it's an exception.
And to understand why, which I think Grant was talking about earlier, if we're going to veer away from what's typical, it's helpful to understand why. Bill?
I wanted to second what follow back to what Yang said. I completely agree with Yang. If you look at the picture on second project needs, and you'll see that there is no sidewalk, as we've been talking about, but there's a trail, and it's close to the railroad. And for no other reason than safety, we've got to get a sidewalk there for people so they don't walk near the railroad tracks. Coming down this afternoon on the bus, looking out the window, there was a pedestrian in this section walking from going west from University Bay. So people are using it, and maybe there'll be a path on the other side. But I think as we think pedestrians, they're going to take the shortest route. And that shortest route is that right now is that trail, and they'll continue to use that until there's a sidewalk.
And I should point out too, although there's the village is creating this multi-use path on the north side, the 10-foot path. There's always been an alley there for people to use. So it's more of a what's the word I'm trying to say? It's legalization of
formal
usage.
Designation.
Yeah. So the difference is, people have been biking and walking in that alley for years and years. So and still, there's been this trail shown on the other side of the track. So I'm not sure. The path will make people feel a lot more welcome, but the dynamic is maybe not that different.
Chris, we're looking at the project schedule. Where are we on that? Are we in environmental documents yet?
We're before that, so
okay.
We're right in the first draft of plans, getting input, and then working towards an environmental document this fall.
So when's the next time we see you two?
Probably this fall.
Yep. Okay.
Yep. So would you plan, I'm just going to piggyback on that, would you plan for this to come back more than one time?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, probably. So typically what we've done in the past with projects like this is have a couple check-ins and then have you guys approve the geometry. And the geometry, this might help with some of the discussions you were having before. So a lot of times the geometry that we bring here is quite detailed. And then the plan specs and estimate was something usually typically that the board approved, referencing that geometry design. So that would be the proposal here as well, is check in a few times, prove the geometry, get a pretty detailed drawing of where the bike lanes are, if they are, what are the lane widths, all those dimensions and things, and what are the components of the project.
I still have
a couple of slides.
There's so much great discussion here. I'm glad to hear there'll be more check-ins before you get to that geometry.
Yes.
So there'll be opportunities.
That's the intention. Yep.
Yep. Opportunities to follow up on some of the thoughts that people have had.
So I think I just have two more larger comments. Schmidt Place, we heard from the Bagels Forever ownership that this would be a very hardship for them to not have this truck entrance. The Bagels Forever operation is this entire block here. Smokey's is also quite against this closing of the intersection. Bagels Forever has trucks that come from the west and then leave to go back west every day. And the concern there is, we also heard from the alder, we don't want to increase truck traffic on Schmidt Place or Harvey Street to get back out to a signal. So, what can we do to help them out? We propose the closing because, with the hill there and the site distance, it's not the greatest. It's a kind of a pinch point. And we did, observing some of the crash records, there has been some crashes associated with that left in. So we propose that. It's kind of an ongoing discussion. We're working with the owner of the Bagels Forever and Smokies, and we'll see. But this is one of the inputs we've got.
Chris, was the median U-turn, was that just east of here, right?
Just east, yeah.
Yeah, and I.
So that was one of the things we hoped would help. It's difficult to get a 53-foot trailer through a U-turn median like that.
I was going to say, you run turning templates on it.
I've seen it happen. I actually saw it happen yesterday. But whether or not, we need to do that, we're still kind of working with the owner. And
I think this is much safer. I really do. Close. Because of the site distance.
Yep. Now, if there's a bunch of 53-foot trucks that are going on Harvey and creating other pedestrian issues, maybe we don't want to do that either. But that's some of the feedback. The last slide I got was the overpass. So we had showed an overpass that just kind of crossed over the intersection. One of the things we heard and was, well, how do I get north and south? What if my destination is north and south on University Bay Drive instead of just wanting to cross? So we had previously looked at a loop ramp here to kind of get you back down to grade, and you can go north and south on that new wide sidewalk that we have planned on the east side of the street. And so this is something that we can bring back. The VA working with them they really pushed us to try to minimize impacts. We'd have to buy out this land from VA. We are not allowed to condemn for this purpose either. Even before the law changed, you cannot condemn a federal property, so we need to have them in working with them. One of the things we are working with them on is potentially a signal with this project just north of here at Marshall Court and U-Bay. And, you know, maybe if we can work out the signal, maybe we can work out a deal to get that loop ramp back in. It that would be 10 foot, yep. It does have to shrink right here. There's not enough room between the building and the railroad property to have a 10-foot path. That would be 8 foot in this pinch point right here, but beyond that, we can go to 10. I think that was it.
With that radius, you can keep it at 5%?
We're not that level yet.
Not,
Okay. Yeah. That was a 5% layout. I'm not sure about the radius.
Fascinating. 52,000 cars a day. That blew my mind.
Yeah, it's a lot
of cars. It's one of the two most the busiest non-freeway arterial streets in the whole state. So another street is also in Madison, that's East Washington Avenue.
Hey, other comments or questions for Chris and Jerry? Okay, more to follow, it sounds like. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks.
Okay, next we have item G2, which is the role of the union, Metro Transit.
Did you wait?
Well, introduce yourselves when you get up to the table, please.
As Aaron is setting up, I'll ask you all to imagine for a moment that for the next several minutes, you're going to have to use a different part of your brain than engineering, geometrics, and physical resources to collective bargaining relationships and human resources. Which on a day-to-day basis at Metro, there's nothing more important. So we thought, since we have a transportation commission, some of you have mentioned you like being on this committee because of the nuts and bolts involved. Our nuts and bolts involve these human resource issues. So we have Greg Leifer is our employee labor and relations manager. We have Aaron Stenson, who is the employee and labor relations specialist that help us work through the issues that we're going to talk about today. On a day-to-day basis, with 490 employees at Metro, 330 of those are drivers, overseen by Chris Michelson, our operations manager. And he works very closely with Rick Wraith, who's our business representative with the Teamsters 695. Is he still here? Yes. There he is. And there's Chris over there. I was pointing in the wrong direction. So these are the key people on a day-to-day basis that help things rolling out in the street where we do service delivery for 182 peak hour buses, 330 drivers. So Aaron is going to go through that, and all of us are available for questions at the end.
Okay. Thank you so much for having all of us here. As exciting as transportation is to you, labor relations and the work we do with the folks at Metro is just that exciting for us. So we're really glad to be here, and we're really glad Greg and I especially are grateful to have Chris and Rick here, who do a lot of the really heavy lifting day-to-day to work through contractual issues down at Metro. And we value their partnership in making all of it work. It's amazing. I think for us to be able to kind of provide direction and have some of the folks, like Chris especially, who are able to move things around really rapidly and make things function in a way that gets all of Metro's needs met and also is contract compliant for us and for Mr. Wraith here. So what we're going to do is just go through really briefly. I see you're used to relatively long discussions, which is great, but we're going to go through relatively briefly just sort of an overview of how labor relations functions down there at Metro Transit, some specifics about the Teamster contract. I think it can be easy sometimes to think we can do, these are decision-making bodies that can make decisions that impact transit there without having to sort of go through other discussions. And what I'm hopeful of is that after this discussion, you'll sort of realize why certain things trigger bargaining or a step back for us to talk to our partners at the Teamsters and to work through those issues more extensively. So the first thing we're going to do is just talk a little bit about the function of labor relations down at Metro, then we're going to talk about the Teamster contract, and then we're going to talk about dispute resolution, but we're going to do it all in a rapid 20 minutes or less.
So as Aaron said, the function of the Labor Relations Office is to represent the mayor in negotiations in the handbook process. So we get our direction from the mayor. I'm going to take these a little bit out of order. We help with dispute resolutions, and we serve as an arbitration representative for the city. So when we do have a dispute, a grievance, and we can't get it resolved at the labor management table, Aaron or I represent the Metro and the city in the arbitration. We give training to our supervisors on contract compliance. We consult with supervisors over discipline. And we specifically consult on performance improvement implementation plans.
So we'll go through sort of some of the foundation of labor relations in the Teamster contract and then more specifically about the contract itself.
So as most of you probably know, federal law and the Transportation Act of 1964 and 13C is something we have to be compliant with, and the Teamsters have to agree that we're compliant with it. That we also have some regulations via state law and MERA, the Municipal Employer Relations Act. Transit is exempt from Act 10, so they retained all full bargaining rights. And then we have contractual law and arbitration precedent that we have to follow also. So we have to balance a number of things. We balance the contract language, and these are not in rank order. We have to balance what the contract language says, what our ordinances say, state law, federal law. MOU stands for Memorandums of Understanding. Grievance resolutions, and past practice. When the contract's silent, we look at the past practice. We may go back and try to figure out what we've done in the past. And then the employer has what's called residual rights that whatever we haven't given away in the contract, what we haven't modified, the employer retains the residual right to control that. How the contract is negotiated. First, we sit down. I think we sat down later last year with Metro Management and started going through putting together a spreadsheet of all the things we looked at in the contract that either were an issue, concern, or something we thought we needed a change in. We figure out what our maximum authority is from the mayor. We name a negotiating team. We open the first meeting. And we have bargaining sessions. We've been bargaining now since early December. If we do not reach resolution in bargaining, if we can't come to a tentative agreement on the contract, we go to mediation under the Wisconsin Employment Relations Commission. It's non-binding. They're a neutral third party. There's no obligation on either side to come to an agreement. If mediation fails, then we go into interest arbitration where we hire an ad hoc third-party arbitrator to hear our cases why the union thinks they're right, why the city thinks we're right. The arbitrator has to pick one or the other as the award. And there's subjects of bargaining. There's mandatory subjects of bargaining. The best way to phrase it is those concerned issues that are surrounding wages, hours, and working conditions. So if it's one of those things, we have a mandatory obligation to bargain it. We don't have an obligation to agree. We just have to bargain. That means we have to exchange proposals. We have permissive subjects of bargaining. These are subjects that we don't have to bargain over. We can exchange proposals if we want to, but we could also say that's a permissive subject and we are not going to bargain that issue. And then there are prohibitive subjects of bargaining, which is things that are contrary to state and federal law, like the right to minimum wage, the right to FMLA, that we cannot bargain. That's a prohibitive subject.
So the Teamster agreement is unique. We do a lot of supervisor trainings throughout the city, and every time we're talking to a group of supervisors from around the city, we say, this is sort of the process we follow, and then we say, and then there's Metro, and Metro is an exception. It is an unusual agreement and a complex agreement. But it's one that has taken decades to sort of develop a firm understanding around and firm agreement, I think, between the parties as to what the meaning of that agreement is. So Greg talked a little bit about what our responsibilities are. The union also has specific responsibilities to the contract and to Metro folks. Our preamble, this slide contains just a little bit about our preamble, and I think one of the things that it does is it describes the mutual commitment that the union and the city make to ensuring that we have a high-quality transit system capable of meeting our community's needs, that our employees are well taken care of, and that our efforts create a sense of belonging for them. And so Rick's going to talk a little bit about the union responsibility specifically.
From the union standpoint, one of the things that we really look at is preserving the relationship between the two sides. And realizing at the end of the day that the bus system needs to run and that people, the buses need to get out on the road. One of the things that we do is negotiate, obviously, over the things in the contract, such as the wages, the hours, the condition of employment, those types of things. We also advocate for the employees and for the employer when dealing with the membership. Explaining to them why the work rule is in place or potential work rules upcoming, those types of things. And through the grievance process with sitting down with Greg and Aaron and the rest of the city's council, kind of going over any issues that may have arisen and coming up with different grievance disputes and resolutions over the table and through bargaining as well. And we also communicate the grievance resolutions back to the membership and those types of things.
So this particular labor agreement covers that $20 million is just benefit straight wages without benefits. And so that doesn't even include some of the high cost items that the contract actually covers. It covers 435 employees in a variety of different positions. We do also have supervisors down at Metro Transit and managers that are not covered by that particular contract, but are covered by other handbooks within the city. And I was shocked when I saw the number, 710,000 hours worked under that agreement, meaning regular hours of driving, overtime hours, time fixing vehicles, the whole gamut. So the current agreement started in 2014 and it expired December 31st of 2018. We began negotiating a new contract right around November, December of 2018. And it's a pretty typical time to start negotiations, even though the negotiation timeline can be relatively long, especially with a complex labor agreement and especially with the lengthy labor agreements that we've been bargaining. Prior to Act 10, which was in 2011, in case you didn't know, we often just negotiated two-year agreements, and those two-year agreements were sort of repetitive, and we got into a relatively easy pattern of renegotiating. After Act 10, it sort of released some of the limitations on how long agreements could be, and we started negotiating longer agreements on behalf of the city. So an agreement might be expected to be as short as 2 years, and might be expected to be as long as 4 to 5 years, dependent. We did just settle labor agreements with police and fire that covered 2018, 2019, 2020, and 2021. So those were four-year agreements, three of which would cross over with a timeline with the Teamsters. While we're in a period of negotiating a successor agreement, we are required to continue to adhere to all of the parameters of the labor agreements. It's not sort of like it's expired, so the city can go and do whatever it wants to do for the time period. It's required that we continue to make sure that we're adhering to everything that we did before. And it covers all of the basic provisions, including overtime, spread time, and Chris can explain that in detail if you like, guarantee time, hours, schedules, vacation, sick leave, disability leave, different conditions of employment, including discipline, required licensure, things like that. And then it also includes sort of what management rights are, and specifically dues deductions. The only thing I would really point out that's really unique about the Teamster contract is that the Teamster contract actually includes specific sort of penalties for specific misconduct and violations. So where you'll sometimes wonder, you know, I understand there was an incident that occurred, and I understand this was the outcome of that incident. It might not make perfect sense at the time. There may be labor agreement language that requires that particular outcome. So we typically just ask Greg and Rick to argue out all disagreements and disputes. We leave them in a small room and hope one of them comes out to tell the story. But we also have actual formal.
Here, right?
What?
They're both here, right?
They're both here. Yeah, they survived this last one. So there are a lot of times where we have disputes. I think we're fortunate with our labor partners. Neither side sees those disputes as something that should damage the relationship, and we continue to hold that relationship as something that's valuable even through those disputes. We have really strong resolution systems for any of those disputes. I think I'm cutting into some of Greg's time, but some of the basic causes of disputes include overtime, staffing, leave, bargaining unit work, holidays, other special provisions. Typically, a grievance will come from a dispute over what a contract might mean or how someone was treated, and then we'll work through resolving that grievance.
I would just add, that we used to average about 50 to 55 grievances a year at Metro. Right now, our grievance docket is down to, what, 8?
Yeah.
And it's been down that low for some time now. So we're really actively trying to get things resolved. Yes.
Just give me an example on overtime. What would be, they'd say, you're giving me too much overtime, you're giving not enough over, what's...
Somebody may have been missed out of seniority selection.
Okay.
Missed
okay.
Or not an opportunity.
So an individual says, I didn't get my share. Okay. Okay.
Most grievances, there's some grievances on the application of the contract. Most of our grievances deal with discipline.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Holiday pay, whether or not somebody was entitled to holiday pay, or whether...
No, the others I could figure out. Yeah. I just couldn't figure out the overtime thing.
Okay. I would just add that one of the things that Chris and our other managers do is we do tell employees when they're having a constructive discussion and they disagree to remind them they have the grievance procedure, and we take that as a constructive process, not as something that we would discourage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So our means of resolution first include grievances. We have a grievance table all of these folks sit at, and we have a number of staff employees from the management side as well as union stewards that sit at that table and work through resolving those grievances. If we're not able to come to agreement on those grievances might go to mediation and they might proceed to arbitration. Typically, we can resolve almost all of our grievances. We have very few that actually end up in arbitration. We've had a couple in the last year, and those were over really significant issues that deserved a neutral third party to decide.
Another thing is that some of the grievances that come to the table, the grievance should be an actual violation of the contract. And a lot of the grievances that come to the table are really just a gripe. We don't refuse to hear it. We can't refuse to hear it. The union owns the grievance, so if they want to present the grievance and have the grievance heard, we have to hear it.
One of the reasons that we do that at times is just to spark a conversation. Realizing that there might not be an actual contractual violation there, but more a means to this is something that's happened. It's become an issue with the membership or could grow into a further issue between the two sides. Let's discuss it out now and try to figure out a way to resolve this issue before it becomes something more.
Does that ever then roll into the next contract talk where you say there was something that wasn't covered before we got it settled, but we really should talk about it now and see whether it should be part of the handbook?
Yes, as a matter of fact, I think there were a couple things that were involved in this bargaining process right now that we had discussed previously. So let's remand this back to bargaining when we get there.
So we're just going to go through the two main disputes from last year really briefly, just to give you an idea of how those come up and how those end up getting resolved. So with the elimination of directly provided paratransit, the city realized it was a service that we wouldn't be providing and that we would have to lay off employees who were driving those paratransit vehicles last year. And when we went to eliminate those positions and move those employees into other positions, those employees obviously felt aggrieved and filed a grievance over our ability to do that under the contract, citing various contract language, some of which included like subcontracting and that sort of thing. We had a dispute with the union over whether or not the contract even allowed us to eliminate those services, and so took that to a neutral third party. And after the arbitrator heard that grievance, he did, in that case, award in favor of the city and indicate that the contract had not been violated by elimination of those positions.
The other grievance that went to arbitration last year was a grievance over what was called the Janus decision from the United States Supreme Court. It was a case involving the mandatory payment of shop fees by non-members, and it overturned a long-standing case, Abood, that said that people that didn't want to be a full member of the union had to pay at least the representational costs of what it costs for the union to represent them, bargain a contract, all of that. And the Supreme Court came through last year. Justice Alito wrote the majority opinion and said this 40-plus-year precedent we think was wrongly decided, and we think that Mark Janus, who was the person who brought the case forward, should not be forced, compelled to pay money because that money is speech. And the union has to get an affirmative consent from the employee before they can have dues taken out of their check or any kind of representational fees. When we got that decision, we looked at it and we said, this is the U.S. Supreme Court. We can't not follow that ruling. So some of the folks down at Metro, not many, a few, opted to stop paying dues. The union filed a grievance. That grievance went to arbitration. The arbitrator said that basically they could just go to the union and say, I don't want to pay dues anymore. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, in our opinion, it was a really badly reasoned award. It caused a lot of comment on the management side around the state. For the union, I'm sure they feel it was a really good award.
Arbitrator did very well, yeah.
Four thumbs up, yeah.
The issue with that is when an employee starts at Metro, they fill out the application for the union, and part of that is an affirmation that they wish to pay dues. We believe there was nothing in the ruling that stated that that agreement was nullified based on the Janus decision. When we presented that, the arbitrator agreed with that, and that initial application stood. And on our application is the grounds with which to withdraw. And if somebody were to follow that, and we have had a few of these people follow through with that, they have been able to get out of their dues payment.
So that's kind of all we have for this evening to share with you. We're happy to answer any questions that you might have. We're also happy to come back if you have specific issues that you need assistance sort of understanding the contractual limitations around.
Other comments or questions?
Does the city, there's other city employees that are Teamsters, is that correct, in the city?
No.
Even like just in engineering or
just
streets?
Transit.
Just transit are the only Teamsters. Okay.
Other comments or questions?
I just want to make a comment. So thank you very much for coming. I think it can be easy to, sit sort of in a one location and, legislate things and make decisions and not necessarily understand some of the repercussions down the road. So appreciate the education.
Other comments or questions?
Just if there's any questions for me. Sorry.
Yes.
So I will close with just a story from the Act 10 that Aaron talked about, where that was a very challenging time period for everybody. And at the time, I just appreciated that
We continued to operate, even though we had a number of elected officials and others that talked about should we have city employees go on strike. And never did the Teamsters leadership or our staff move from our mission statement, which is to transport people to jobs and to school, whatever the circumstances. And so I appreciate, even if some arbitrations go in one direction, some go in another direction, when it comes to basic provision of service and safety, there is a strong partnership between the City of Madison and the Teamsters.
Mm-hmm. I heard very clearly both sides have the same mission, which is Metro's mission to move people from here to there. Mm-hmm. So I think that's great. Ken.
Greg, how long is the Janus arbitrator's decision?
How long? What?
How lengthy is it?
It's not that long. The arbitration award is not that long. The Supreme Court.
Yeah, I know the Supreme Court's decision.
It's like 40-some pages.
Chuck, could you have it sent out on a link?
The Supreme Court decision?
No.
The arbitrator's decision?
The arbitration decision.
I believe it was 3 pages long.
The essence of what the arbitrator felt in his award was that dues checkoff that they signed gives them a specific time period they can revoke it every year, and that was the controlling document,
okay.
Not the United States Supreme Court decision.
Right. No, I'm familiar with the Janus decision, but I'm just interested in hearing.
Yep, we will get that to you. Thanks. Via Patrick.
Other comments or questions? Thank you very much for coming. Very interesting presentation.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Hey, Chuck, you're still up with the commute card?
Yes, I think Mick is still here. Has waited patiently. And
thanks, Mick.
As background on this, the mayor has several times mentioned the importance of the commute card, and is there any way to beef up the program? And our staff sat down and looked at ways to market it even more with some adjustments. And Mick and his staff are in the process of looking at that now, and he can kind of summarize where we're headed.
I guess the big thing with the commute card is we signed up about 110 businesses, 115 businesses so far, and basically Peg Anthony and Jesse Stammer, they hit pretty much everyone along the isthmus. And basically the problem with our program right now is we charge $1.40 per ride, and we charge for every transfer. So if someone needs to make a transfer, it's more than the cash fare. So if they have to make a transfer, the companies aren't interested in it. So we kind of, we actually stopped marketing it and just worked on servicing the 115 groups that we have right now, just because we had a group like Quick Trip was very interested in it, but all of their people were on the periphery and it just didn't make sense for them. So now that we've got this new directive to look at this program more, we're trying to figure out how to get around that or improve that. So what we are proposing is to change it where we would cap a monthly charge of $65, which is the monthly pass that we have right now. So basically, the commute card would bill it just like we are now, $1.40 per ride with the transfer. But if they hit $65, we would just cap it out at that, and then it would be just like a monthly pass. So we think if we put that out there, that'll get the transfer issue, kind of put that to rest, and then we'll be able to sign more people up.
Mm-hmm. And there is some benefit in terms of the employees can use pre-tax dollars,
mm-hmm.
right?
Correct.
And employers can help subsidize as well. So comments or questions for Mick and Chuck?
We'll keep you posted as we implement this.
Good.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thanks. Thanks for staying for that.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. Okay. Item G4, our traffic engineering and parking warm weather tour. So So are we July or September? Looks like we might have failed on the July date, huh? So it looks like we're going to be pushed off to September. We all voted that August was too busy. So, Patrick, you're working on the September date? Do we have a date?
Well, the most...
Most popular?
And was either the 10th or the 11th.
Okay. So either September 10th or September 11th. So, Patrick, if you want to get the date out to people, maybe send an invitation out so that folks can get it on their calendar so we don't give that away to somebody else.
Patrick, what was the date or time on the 11th? In the morning or afternoon?
The morning.
Both in the morning?
Yeah.
Okay.
So it'd be 10, right?
Either way, when I get back to my desk, I'll know.
Okay. I'll have to change the doctor's appointment if it's on the 11th in the morning.
So all I know is that the majority of the people that said they could, it was all the same date, the same time.
Okay.
All right. Well, Patrick will get an invitation out to people so we can get it on our calendars.
Yeah. Okay.
And if, if we need to have a second one, we can certainly arrange for a second one at a future time. Anything else on the warm weather tour? We better get it in faster. It won't be warm weather anymore, right? Yeah. All right. So we now have two crossover members with Chris and Grant. So do you guys want to update us on the last policy board meeting?
You want to do it this one?
My update would be that I've now been to both.
Okay.
I think you should go.
Right. The big item was the interim recommendations for the Wilson corridor that we heard about tonight. We selected the chair and vice chair. So Tom Wilson, who was here this evening, was re-elected as chair, and I got selected as vice chair. So this is the only board, committee, or commission that allows for an alder to sit?
Yeah, it's right. The language is right in the ordinance. Yeah. That because it's an alder, I think the rationale was there are more alders on that body. So
it was a conversation that happened during TORC, and so that was that included in that ordinance. So we'll see how that works. And then there was a short presentation about an opportunity to potentially improve transit access for the new Penny Library. So I won't go into details, but I expect that would come here when there's actually kind of the detailed plan for that. But it seems like maybe a good opportunity there. We talked a little bit about the e-scooter pilot program and policy, and I think high level there's some real concerns from the mayor's office and other staff, particularly around some of the safety concerns with e-scooters and what cities have been seeing.
It's been enacted.
What's that?
Governor signed it.
So the governor signed a bill, but then there's a question. We had considered as a city whether we wanted to work actively with one of the companies on a pilot, and so more work to be done, I think, is the answer there. But I would expect that we'll be dealing with the topic in one way or the other sometime in the next few months. I think the public has a lot of questions about just the legality of them. But then again, from the city's perspective, I think there's questions around the kind of the business model and some of the impacts that might have. So we didn't really get into a lengthy discussion, just basically saying this is something we need to talk about in the future. And we also, I think the other big thing is we just got a look at the Department of Transportation work plan, which I think was really helpful for board members to see what staff is working on or charged with. And I think the board is interested in looking at its priorities and seeing kind of what like the commission has done, trying to kind of lay out a little bit in advance what items the board should be tackling and understanding how that fits with the staff's priorities as well. So I think that's kind of the summary of our last meeting there.
Okay. Any comments or questions for Grant or Chris? Okay, thank you very much. Okay, announcements by the chair. We had initially tried for August 5th for a joint TCTPBB, that's hard to say, TPBB meeting, and that date has gone by the wayside. The latest, which excuse me, Patrick sent out and is polling people on, is Tuesday, August 27th from 5 to 8. All the alders, my understanding is from Tom Wilson, is that all the alders can attend and all the TPPB members can attend. So hopefully we'll have a quorum. I think we're close to a quorum, I think, of Transportation Commission members, because my understanding from John Strange is we'll actually have a commission meeting and a policy board meeting at the same time. So we need to have quorums of each body in order to hold each of the meetings, my understanding anyway. So we'll let you know, but I've got that penciled in on my calendar. So if you can, just sort of hold that date, August 27th from 5 to 8, and we'll let you know for sure. And we're working on an agenda for that meeting as well. Metro Transit Tours, July 15th at 10:30 and July 18th at 9 o'clock. I think you got an email from Patrick with those dates. So if you haven't been on a tour and would like to go on a tour, you have two more opportunities for that. Then future agenda items. We have a lot. A lot coming here. We have the speed humps on Spade Street. I think that's coming on the 24th. Is that right, Yang? We have our organizational meeting. So I've been honored to be your chair and enjoy certainly that role. And we'll see, what kind of selection process we have when we get to the 24th. Safe routes to school. We'll have a report from the special rules subcommittee. We're meeting tomorrow. Taxicab license renewal process update from Amber McReynolds in the city attorney's office. Possibly Legistar training if we have time. And we have one big agenda item, and that's the update on Madison Police Department. The quarterly traffic safety report. We spent a great deal of time at the last meeting talking about that. And I know, Bill, you had some comments about that. So I want to make sure when we have that discussion that we have a big chunk of time available to do that, because it's a great proactive tool that everybody is very interested in. And I think, Yang, you've done a great job working with the police department, so I want to make sure we have plenty of time. So, Bill, I know you had some comments on that.
Right, and Yang and I had a conversation, or in that meeting on the topic, and Yang is absolutely correct. The state has not completed the 2018 final crash report. And
here we are in July, right?
And I... The preliminary has been done, is available for about a month. And so I went back to the UW at the TOPS lab and found out a little bit of why that is. The state does not even start their verification of all of their records for 3 months. The reason is they give time for the local agencies to get their crash reports in. Even then, at 3 months, they may still receive reports after that. By state statute, the locals have a long time. And I think that has led, to one of the things that they're able to do with the new system, with the TRAX system, how the crash reports get into the state, they can they can do a lot more verification of finding errors that are in the report that have been submitted by local law enforcement. And I think this is good. Whereas they used to only maybe 7 or 8, 9, something like that. Now they can do 40. And things like children in child safety seats and things like that, and what's the age of the children, and things that don't make sense in the crash reports, they can go back. And I think what they're going to try to do is to speed up that and not wait for a year before they start that process, and that makes sense because apparently they get zero cooperation from the city of Milwaukee as far as getting updates. They just say, no, we're moved on. We gave you our best information last year. We're not going back and taking a look at those things. So, but I think there is some opportunity or room for some discussion with the Madison PD as far as how they get their crash reports into the state system. Anybody, when I say anybody, Yang and his team can look at it, but also a citizen can also look. But what Yang can look at is with proper credentials, can look at much more details as far as information in those reports. But you can't look at them until the law enforcement submits it to the state. Literally, once the report is into the state system, then you can look at it like less than a week later. You can have access to it. But there's a hesitancy on some agencies and some supervisors, and I think that might be a discussion that I'd like to have with Madison PD as to what is their norms as far as trying to get crash reports into the state system. They can always amend it. They can always amend it. I think they've got up to 4 years to amend it. But if they don't have the information into the system, nobody really knows that. Maybe you saw it in a newspaper or a blog or something that there was a crash, but at least the preliminary information should be submitted. And then community maps. Once it's into the state system, everybody can use community maps to start plotting and looking at where their crashes are in a much more timely basis. So I think that's good. But the actual final report, if you will, which is kind of what they submit then to Washington, to National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and so forth, that's that takes a little bit longer. But I think having preliminary data, for the most part, serves everybody's majority of their needs, I think, and to start looking at issues and what needs to be addressed.
So we should be able to do it quicker, is what you're saying.
Right, right. With preliminary data versus waiting for the final report.
Okay. So for critical crashes,
yes,
like fatalities, serious injuries, we do request, if it's MPD response to the thing, we do request the reports from them, and typically we get it much quicker.
Do they? Do you see it after when it's been into the state system, or is it even before they submit it
to the state system?
Things like,
but we don't get it for every single crash.
Yeah.
We don't request for the critical ones.
They send them to you or a copy and say draft or something like that on it, so it's not been submitted yet.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. There's cases where there's, particularly when there's criminal. A case involved, they may be some hesitancy about submitting it into the state system. But they can always amend it. That's the thing.
Good. Ken?
So this is interesting. So there's actually a state employee who that gets sent in, and they are using critical thinking to say, does this crash make sense?
That's right.
I'm impressed.
Yeah. But they don't start that until
filled March or April.
Okay.
So one of the points that I wrote down as I'm sort of tracking these future agenda items is, and I think maybe, Grant, you made the point last time, was we talk about quarterly traffic safety, that what I was hearing Bill say, and I heard a lot of you say it, it may be the annual crash report isn't as relevant to us, that we should be incorporating right. that information into the quarterly traffic safety report. So we're talking about that crash data and right. along with the other things. So it's a way to consider speeding up the process.
Recognizing that it's preliminary.
Right.
But even the state, I think, is looking at quarterly, you right. know, of trying to get, not to say it's final, but say here's trend lines, just like the chief of police sends out his quarterly reports on how many burglaries and all those kinds of cases. Well, the same thing I think could happen with crash information and traffic information.
And start doing the mapping. Mike, you were talking about mapping as being very valuable.
Yeah.
To be able to look at where these things are happening.
Yeah, we have access, or Yang, and you know, could use community maps.
Right, but more, it sounds like if we use preliminary data that it could be more time sensitive and mm-hmm. more time responsive.
Right.
So we'd be looking at information that would be much more current than what we've done. We're still working on the 2017 crash stuff, right, in terms of the analysis.
We finished analysis, so we're just developing projects.
Right.
So we're in that stage.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. But this seems like a possibility of focusing on more current and relevant information, which is what we've been talking about. So when we do put this on the agenda, whether it's the 24th or it's a meeting in August, I want it to be an agenda that has a lot of time on it for us to talk about it. So other future agenda items.
I just want to say one more thing about that, if you don't mind.
Sure.
So from my recollection, one of the worst intersections in Madison for crashes is, and I think it's mostly left turns or right turns, is included in that stretch of University that the presentation was on today. I don't know if anybody knows, but it would be nice. It would be nice to get that tie-in
mm-hmm.
with, you know, some of that crash data, and then the the engineering plan and how that right. might help address mm-hmm. some of the crashes. Because if I remember correctly, it was that intersection on University
and the Ridge.
Yeah,
that
yeah,
was one of the top intersections. However, though, that's because there was a fatality. Over there, because according to a new ranking developed actually by the UW Tough Lab, we use the we call it the property damage only equivalent ranking.
Yep.
So that means one fatal crash will be equivalent to many, many property damage only crashes. Mm-hmm. So just because that fatal crash, mm-hmm. the ranking for that incident is really high.
Okay.
However, you know, for that particular one, you know, we look at that one, you know, actually the same day when it happened. There is a lot, whole lot of things we can do from engineer's perspective. It's really, it's very strategic. It's very tragic. A little kid on a bike on registry, you know, runs to into the right light. So there is some traffic on University Avenue. Mm-hmm. The car in the right-hand lane saw the boy, was able to stop. But the car in the second lane, because the view was blocked by the car in the first lane, so that car didn't stop, and he's a child. That was very tragic.
So I just, my only point is just that it would be nice to kind of hear that whole picture of, hey, this is also what's going or what has been going on in this area that we're going to be re-engineering, and this is a consideration.
Yeah, yeah. We reviewed all the crashes for the project, so those definitely going to be part of consideration when we do the design. Yeah.
Any other future agenda items? Okay. I'll entertain a motion to adjourn.
So moved.
Second. Motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? Motion carried. Thanks, everybody.